The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
To do movies between now and 7 o'clock, we have Rob McDermott, the film editor with Hot Press Magazine, and Brian Lloyd, movies editor of Entertainment.ie. And Pitch Perfect is back. Pitch Perfect 3. Ro, I thought Pitch Perfect 1 was great fun. Mm-hmm. Pitch Perfect 2 was grand, fine. Pitch Perfect 3, are they not taking the risk here of overdoing it?
This trilogy has, in the words of Eddie Izzard, slowly collapsed like a flan in a cupboard, unfortunately. But it's the end of the year, so, and it's the last. They have promised that it's the last in the series. I'm going to hold them to it. So, but I think it is. I mean, it is worth remembering how charming and fresh the original Pitch Perfect was. That really put on display Anna Kendrick's talent as both a singer, a really funny comedic actress. She also has this cynical edge that I think she often doesn't get to play with in films. And then it had this, you know, really strong female cast of a cappella singers. I was really funny and kind of embraced the idealism and the music of kind of that Glee style show.
It was a great family movie. Actually, I went with all my kids to see it and we had a great fun watching it.
Yeah, it was very good. Yeah, like exactly what Ro was saying. Anna Kendrick was brilliant in it as well. I thought she had this real kind of edge to it that was interesting. But yeah, the second one I think was a bit sort of like, okay, look, the first one was a surprise hit. So let's just get something into production pretty quickly. You had Elizabeth Banks, who was primarily known for doing comedic acting. She took on the directing of it. And it was much the same.
It was fine, but it didn't have the originality of the first. There was no surprises. Like, the first one was a surprise.
And this is it. Like, there's only so many times you can have, like, a musical number where it's kind of taking an original song or something that's well known and then doing something different with it and then having some sort of comedy layered
over. I think they did elevate it in the second one, because in the second film they kind of go against other international a cappella groups. So they have these crazy European groups and they go into competition with them. So there was an element of, okay, this is, you know, heightening the ridiculousness.
Yeah, but what threw me, that one of the singers was the journalist in Borgen, the Danish.
Yes, I know.
Hang on, she's now turned up in this? Okay.
A slight tonal change in her roles there. Yeah, so in Pitch Perfect 3, it's a few years on. It's 3 years after the second movie. So they're all in their mid-20s. They've all graduated. They're trying to succeed in the real world with real jobs and relationships. They're all failing miserably, like quarter-life crises galore. So they decide to reunite one last time and go on a USO tour, which is where the a cappella groups go and they entertain the troops abroad. So they're traveling around Europe. And at the end of it, so they have, there's a few other bands doing this tour as well. And at the end of it, DJ Khaled is going to pick one of the bands to be a supporting act at one of his gigs. So again, they're thrown into this kind of competitive style, except they're not up against a cappella groups anymore. They're up against real bands, including, and I do apologize for saying this word, but it's the name of the band, Ruby Rose from Orange is the New Black. Her band is called Ever Moist. So these are these like cool rock chick girls, and the a cappella group are now feeling very insecure because everyone else are really secure bands, and they're already in a tailspin of their identity and do they have any talent, and, you know,
did you say quarter life crisis? What age is Rebel Wilson? Oh, we're not allowed to mention
we're
that,
not
are
allowed.
We?
Oh, no, it's all very not, controversial.
No, that's not, okay, let's not go there.
But she gets a good subplot because Fat Amy, as she is known, her long estranged father reappears in the form of John Lithgow with a very hammy Australian accent, who is this multi-millionaire, and it gets quite dodgy in terms of is he trying to reconnect with her? Is he using her for something? Let me just say, there's a kidnapping plot, there's an exploding yacht, it goes full on action comedy schlock, which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. I think the brilliant thing about Pitch Perfect is they always acknowledge the tropes that they were using. Fat Amy was called Fat Amy. Now they're not really acknowledging how ridiculous the plot gets, and that's when it slightly goes off the rails for me.
Okay, we have a clip here. I'm not sure if this is from Pitch Perfect, the original movie, or Pitch Perfect 3, but it's where the Bellas explain to a rival team what a riff-off is.
What is a riff-off?
A riff-off is a little game that we like to play. Mm-hmm. We start with a beat.
Oh, yeah, bring it, Bellas!
Oh, go, ladies.
I'm coming up, so you better get this party started.
I'm coming up,
I'm coming up.
Back, just keep your eyes on me. I said you're holding back. She said, shut up and dance with me.
That toot toot,
let me get that
beep beat.
Running her hands from the throne, bouncing my tiny phones while they sing on the radio.
It's a remix to ignition. I'm fresh out the kitchen.
I'm rolling in my 6'4".
I'm told that is from the new movie Pitch Perfect 3. Want to wait and watch, maybe see on Netflix in a few years' time?
Yeah, I think it is. It's going to be good kind of background viewing. Again, it's good maybe for over Christmas, but I would kind of wait to see it. Okay, the performances are good in terms of the music. They have a good rendition of Toxic. They have Cheap Thrills. They have I Don't Like It, I Love It. But the rest of the movie doesn't really live up to the performances on stage.
Let's get Christmas picks. The classic Christmas movies for you to watch for whatever platform you can find them. What's your main choice, Brian?
I picked two. I had the first one was It's a Wonderful Life, and actually you say streaming platforms. This was actually screened in IFI last weekend, and it's shown in the Lighthouse, I think, this weekend. So there's plenty of Dublin cinemas are showing It's a Wonderful Life.
Which is, how many years old now?
Oh, God.
It's 1941 or
something. Something like that, yeah. But I mean, the funny thing of it is that this was the first time I'd watched It's a Wonderful Life since I was a kid, anyway.
That was the first time seeing it in the cinema rather than
in the
television.
Cinema as well, yeah. But the point of it is that what kind of struck me about it was the fact that it was actually so prescient and actually had a lot of themes in it that are very relevant, not only to, you know, the world today,
yeah,
but specifically
for those
to Ireland.
Who are not familiar with the movie, explain the premise.
So basically, George Bailey, who's played by Jimmy Stewart, contemplates ending his life. Throughout the film, it's sort of told in flashback that, you know, he was this young man who wanted to leave this sleepy town called Bedford Falls. Through circumstances, you know, his father dies or whatever, he takes over this building and loans company, which I suppose is kind of like a credit union.
Savings and loans.
Savings and loans, yeah. Well, whatever, the credit union sort of thing. Anyways, he is working in Bedford Falls and he is fighting with this local property developer slash arch capitalist called Mr. Powell. I want to say Powell, yeah, whatever. Anyway. And so it's him essentially trying to, you know, build up the town, help his fellow man, help his family. But through a sort of weird, I forget what it was. It was $8,000 or something went missing, essentially. And the company was going to be taken over by the evil arch capitalist. He contemplates ending his life because his life insurance policy is worth $15,000 and that will cover the debt of the loan, saving and loans company. But then this angel appears, called Clarence, who shows him what his life would be like if he had never been born in the first place. And then he has this massive moment of realization that no, actually it was a wonderful life and he can help all these people. And it's funny because, you know, the character, the evil land baron, if you like, you know, he's this landlord who is, you know, keeping most of the town under his own kind of control or whatever, but there's only like a small part of the town that's it's people who own their own homes. And it's the idea of like the landlord is trying to keep everyone in his rented properties, whereas, you know, George Bailey's character, yeah, exactly.
Irish that is.
I was watching, I was like, this is amazing, this is still completely relevant, even though like it's 1940s and, you know, Jimmy Stewart's kind of performance is a little bit theatrical in places, but it's still very relevant. Like,
okay, what's your first choice?
So I'm going to go with an absolute classic on Christmas Day, RTÉ2, it's 6:05 PM, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, because I don't think it is Christmas without it. And I also just want to remind people of how good the original is if their dreams and childhood has been tainted by that terrible Johnny Depp remake.
Trying to play it as Michael Jackson.
Yeah, with the kind of weird hip hop Oompa Loompa. So I think we have to go back to the original. And I think one thing that I think the Johnny Depp version was trying to do was to capture the darkness of Willy Wonka. But I think Gene Wilder does that beautifully in the original, from the first moment where he walks out on the carpet in front of the chocolate factory to these kids who have won golden tickets to come visit, and comes out on a walking stick, is limping along, and then suddenly does a tumble, and you just realise that you're never going to know what to expect with this person.
John from Limerick says, It's a Wonderful Life was made in 1946. Do you not remember George's brother Harry won the Congressional Medal
of Honour
after the war? My apologies for that. And Kevin in Donegal, I saw It's a Wonderful Life for the first time in colour on the Gold Channel at the weekend.
Oh yeah.
But one film won't be on terrestrial TV, which is lovely. It's Elf, which I think we all love. Elf.
Oh yeah, Elf.
That's
great,
one of my picks. Yeah, I love that.
Just remind people what Elf is. This is possibly the best movie for his name has gone out of my head.
Will Ferrell,
who was here with Dermot and Dave only a couple of weeks ago. Yes.
Yeah.
His best performance, maybe.
I think it's definitely one of his most watchable, and I think it's a film that works on both levels. Like, adults will love it, kids absolutely adore it. So the story is about Buddy, who realizes after being raised in the North Pole that he is not a real elf, which he might might have guessed, seeing as he is 6'4". So he decides to head back to his place of birth, New York City, in search of his biological family. So the cast is amazing. It has James Caan, Mary Steenburgen, Zooey Deschanel, and Bob Newhart. And it's just endlessly quotable, seeing Will Ferrell in this irrepressibly happy elf caricature, but trying to navigate this cynical New York, but then bringing families together. There's a sing-off. He has this really awkward and sweet romance with Zooey Deschanel, and just, you know, staring at a mall Santa and saying, "You sit on a throne of lies." You know, there are just so many quotes from this movie. I just think it's great
fun. Okay, we'll take one more. Another one that you have here, and I think we'll have the clip from it, a little bit of Bill Murray here, but just remind us of Scrooge.
Scrooge, yeah, this was Bill Murray. He plays this kind of angry TV executive who is trying to put on a live performance of A Christmas Carol, and then he experiences his own Christmas Carol, where he's visited by the ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Scrooged.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think we're a little bit late. Sir, Merry Christmas. Thanks for the talk.
Thank you. We don't want to scare the dickens out of people.
Merry Christmas, Miss Cooley.
The dickens out of people. Nobody gets it.
Grace, who is that guy?
Elliot Loudermilk.
Okay. Call security, have them change his locks, clean out his desk, and toss him out of the building.
Oh, he's fired? But it's Christmas.
Thank you. Call accounting, stop his bonus.
Ooh, a clear shot at his back.
Elliot Loudermilk, code 9.
Grace, what in the hell is this?
Well, that's a painting one of my kids did. There's Santa Claus, and there's Mrs. Claus.
Honey, how many fingers does Mrs. Santa Claus have here?
11.
11. Right. It's crap. Lose it. I don't want it on the wall.
What I love about Scrooge is the fact that Bill Murray starts off and he is a complete a-hole. And throughout the entire film, he is just like this really angry, cynical person, even when Karen Allen comes back into it and tries to make him feel better. And it's only at the end of it that we see him and he's like completely fevered and he's like staring down the barrel of the camera and he's screaming at you like, no, it can happen to you. The miracle happened to me. It can happen to you. But yeah, like there are so many like one-liners and pratfalls and all the kind of stuff in Scrooge that I think for my money I think it's up there with Ghostbusters as one of Bill Murray's best roles.
One listener says all four Murray brothers were in Scrooge.
Yep, that's right.
And Robin Monaghan says Die Hard is the top Christmas film, not Christmas Without It.
This just starts so many arguments. People who claim it's
a Christmas
film.
Movie, but shut up about it, like, seriously.
So is Gremlins by that meter as well.
All right, a few listeners have mentioned one which is on television on Channel 4 Christmas Eve at 6:30, A Muppet's Christmas Carol.
This is brilliant. I firmly believe this is one of the best tellings of A Christmas Carol. Michael Caine was fantastic as Scrooge.
And there have been so many retellings.
Oh, yeah,
saying a lot.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, absolutely. This one still stands up to it, absolutely, yeah. And then you have Gonzo as Charles Dickens and you have Kermit as... what's his name? Tiny Tim's father was...
We're going to play a clip because this is where Kermit tries to convince Scrooge to put some coal on the fire.
Hey, boys, pack some. Tell him, Mr. Come on.
If you please, Mr. Scrooge, it's gotten colder. Yeah. Any bookkeeping staff would like to have an extra shovel full of coal for the fire?
We can't do the bookkeeping.
Yeah, all of our pens have turned to inksicles.
Yeah, our assets are frozen.
How would the bookkeepers like to be suddenly...
unemployed!
This is my island in the sun.
I believe you convinced them once again, Mr. Scrooge.
Bob Cratchit.
Bob
His
Cratchit.
Name is Bob Cratchit. There
Before
we go.
We
Bob
fired.
Cratchit. I got it.
Okay, that is your first pick of movies. Now, actually, listener says you can buy Elf in Lidl on DVD.
Oh, yeah.
Remember
good.
DVDs? And apparently other Christmas films there as well. Scrooge and Home Alone both on Channel 4 on Christmas Day up against Spectre and RT1.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Spectre's not great. Well, Spectre's all right.
It's not good. Yeah. Okay, what's your first role, your first TV pick? You have Willy Wonka already. What other ones are you suggesting for
I'm
going
to go for an adult one, just when the adults want to escape, because I'm sure DVDs are going to be replayed over and over again. The songs from Frozen are going to be stuck in your head. So on Stevens' Day on Film 4 at 9 p.m, Ex Machina is on, which I think is such an overlooked little film. It's an emotionally complex and really unnerving examination of the relationships and ethical questions that... that arise using AI. So it stars Donald Gleason as Caleb, who is a programmer selected to interact with Ava, who is a robot played by Alicia Vikander, and she's incredibly lifelike, and she's been created by this mercurial tech genius Nathan, who's played by Oscar Isaac. So Caleb begins to really form this relationship with Ava, like that's almost flirtatious, and so then he begins to question like the efficacy of Nathan controlling her every move and keeping her captive. But is Ava actually such a smart AI that she's manipulating him to feel this way? So it's a really dark, complicated little film. It's really interesting about technology. It's interesting about gender. And I think it's all the performances in it are incredible. And I think it's basically the dark version of Spike Jonze's Her. And I think it's a really interesting watch. So when you're sick of all the cheeriness and
actually,
light.
We're moving off to sort of, we might get back to a few Christmassy Christmas movies. These are things to watch. Because you have picked one for Christmas night, Brian.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure most Irish people have probably seen at this stage.
They have, but it's the Irish TV premiere of it, so I was trying to throw it in anyway. It's on 9:30 RT1.
Which
it's,
is Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yeah. It was Saoirse Ronan, and this was the one of her great roles. It's based on Colm Tobin's novel. You also have Donald Gleeson, Jim Broadbent, and Julie Walters in there. It's about an Irish woman living with her mother in the 1950s, decides to make a fresh start in America. She moves to New York, falls in love, but then her past catches up with her and she receives bad news from Ireland. She has to return home.
She's shot really in good, and it's escorted. A really good performance.
It's really one of those films.
Donald Gleeson is so underplayed when you consider the way he is in Star Wars.
That's the thing. That's why I always throw in Donald Gleeson in Star Wars, because I think in that he's so theatrical and so comic book evil. Whereas in Brooklyn, he's so believable. So believable and so quiet and so kind of good natured and just wants to do the right thing. But it's even funny as well is the fact that the script was written by Nick Hornby, who did High Fidelity
and About a Boy.
And he really, I thought, captured the kind of the psychology of Irish people and how we kind of deal with each other and how we deal with, you know, people who come away and come back.
And I think over Christmas, that's what makes it so emotional as well, because a lot of people who've been visiting home for Christmas who have left, and that kind of story of immigration, like it's universal. Timeless.
Yeah, even if it is set in the 50s, it's still just as relevant today for people who are coming home.
Absolutely.
You know.
You've picked a movie for the 28th row, which I actually have never seen.
Have you? And it's an Oscar winner.
I know, that's probably one of the reasons why I haven't. Sometimes, you know, when you get all the hype about Oscar movies, you don't bother. Birdman.
I think this is such an incredible movie, particularly after the past couple of years we've been inundated with superhero movies. But as we all know, Michael Keaton was known as Batman and kind of moved away from movies for a little bit and came back with this role, which was just so perfect and meta for him, because he plays an actor who, you know, earlier in his career became famous as this Batman-esque has-been movie star playing Birdman. But now he's trying to, you know, get some credibility back by putting on a performance of Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love in the theatre, except his ex-persona of Birdman is still in his head telling him that everybody is out to get him, that he should be a big star, that he knows best, and maybe he really doesn't. So it's this examination of ego, it's an examination of theatre, but the way it's shot is so incredible. Alejandro Iñárritu, he shot it in 8 takes, so it starts, you know, outside in Times Square in New York, and it weaves into the theatre and it goes backstage and it follows Michael Keaton's character, but it all looks like it's one take, so it's this really overwhelming like cinematic experience. It's beautiful. Emma Stone is in it, Edward Norton, and it is just this hilarious and tragic look at ego, fame, and kind of middle age and identity crisis that, you know, arise there.
Okay, some more comments from listeners. Raiders of the Lost Ark is without doubt the greatest Christmas time movie.
Yeah, that's I think that's out on Christmas Eve, I think it is.
Yeah, it's on TV.
Shane Lucan says Lethal Weapon 1 and Trading Places are brilliant Christmas movies.
Very true.
What is the definition of Christmas or reason? Because I would also claim Edward Scissorhands is a Christmas movie, because a lot of the action takes place at Christmas. It's just that Christmas is involved, or are we going for the spirit of Christmas? They're two very different things. Nightmare Before Christmas, is that a Christmas movie or a Halloween movie? It gets complicated.
Sound of Music?
Yeah, I'd call it. No, I know there are parts of it that are set at Christmas, but no, I would not define it as a Christmas movie. I wouldn't, anyway.
The Back to the Future films are worthwhile Christmas viewing, says listener. Brilliant entertainment. They're not Christmas movies.
They're not
sort of family movies.
They're the ones
Christmas.
That are always on over Christmas, yeah.
You've mentioned Uncle Buck.
Yeah, True Uncle Buck. Classic. Because it's a classic, and like John Candy is so funny in it, and Macaulay Culkin is brilliant in it.
But actually, let's hear the clip from Uncle Buck.
Where do you live?
In the city.
Do you have a house?
Apartment.
On a rent?
Rent.
What do you do for a living?
Lots of things.
Where's your office?
I don't have one.
How come?
I don't need one.
Where's your wife?
Don't have one.
How come?
It's a long story.
Do you have kids?
No, I don't.
How come?
It's an even longer story.
Are you my dad's brother?
What's your record for consecutive questions asked?
38.
I'm your dad's brother, all right.
You have much more hair on your nose than my dad.
How nice of you to notice.
I'm a kid, that's my job.
It's brilliant, yeah, and like that was written by John Hughes, who of course did Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Breakfast Club, all those great teen comedies. But yeah, the relationship that John Candy builds with the entire family, not just Macaulay Culkin, it's really warm. And like, that's the one thing about John Candy that I think people really responded to, was the fact that he was this warm, generous character, and it was genuine, you know. That sort of, it never felt like it was being kind of forced.
Actually,
or anything.
Listener also says Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
Great film.
That's,
yes,
also on every Christmas. Yeah. That's
Thanksgiving
movie.
Though, that's Thanksgiving, that's not Christmas.
I know, yeah,
but
it's same
still kind of buzz.
It's,
yeah.
It's got a buzz, same and it's a fantastic buzz. Movie. Yeah. Yes, okay. We've come towards the end, unfortunately. Thank you very much for all your contributions. Roe McDermott, film editor with Hot Press Magazine, and Brian Lloyd from entertainment.ie. And we look forward to having loads more movie discussions throughout 2018 with you on a Thursday evening. So thank you very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.